Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on stories that we're following this week. And the big one is healthcare, which is supposedly in its endgame stage. But Capitol Hill is now embroiled in a debate over procedure.
They're already uneasy about the way this is playing out. Now you're saying it's going to be this Byzantine procedural rule that nobody understands. You lose the trust of the public at some point. This bill's too big to do it that way.
That's Democratic Congressman Jason Altmaier of Pennsylvania. You lose the trust of the public at some point. I think we may have passed that point already. But right now, the argument is not over the health care bill at this moment. It's over how we get it done. There are those who want a decision and don't care how it happens. To explain, we've got our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So the latest is we're hearing, okay, first of all, we now know as the American public more about reconciliation as a procedure in Washington than anybody ever probably wanted to know.
Right.
But the Byzantine procedure that Jason Altmaier is talking about is not reconciliation. This is a bizarre rule that's going to allow them possibly to pass the health care bill in the House without voting on it. How does that work?
Well, that's right. Reconciliation's involved, but only tangentially. So another twist in this gnarled vine of rules here. Every bill, Celeste, that comes to the House floor comes with what's called a rule. And a rule goes through the gatekeeper of the House Rules Committee. And a rule just says, here's how many hours you get for this debate. Here's how many amendments you get. And then we're going to vote on passing the bill. And every bill that comes to the floor has a rule that governs that. Well, what Democrats are considering having here is a rule that says, once the House votes on this rule, the House will approve the rule. The Senate bill, which a lot of Democrats don't want to vote for a lot of reasons, once they vote on this rule, the Senate bill is automatically passed. Poof. Just like that. You pass the rule, the bill is passed. Another thing they might do, a variation on this, have a rule that says once they vote on the reconciliation package of fixes, which they also have to vote on, which is popular, a lot of people want to support it. Hey, once you vote on the reconciliation package, poof, Senate bill passed automatically without having to actually cast a vote on that Senate bill. That's what they're considering doing, and that's why Democrats like Jason Altmaier, who you just heard from, don't like it. Now, not all Democrats don't like it, but he's one Democrat who doesn't. Frankly, he didn't vote for it the first time, so why would he like it this time?
Well, some Democrats, as I understand, are privately saying that this would be a way for them to vote for the bill without actually having to go on record.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's sort of the point. Listen to Lynn Woolsey. She's a progressive Democrat from California. She's for this bill, sort of articulating that yes, we just have to get this done, and protecting Democrats from what's potentially an unpopular vote is okay. Listen to Woolsey.
I can tell you that my constituents aren't going to fault me for taking a step that has to be taken in order to get the Senate bill fixed if we have to vote for it first.
It sounds to me like there's just kind of an acknowledgement that the American public just wants this to be done, one way or the other, right?
Well,
they want this debate to be over.
And that's what a lot of the progressives say. And they frankly say, look, this has been hard enough. There's a lot of stuff in that Senate bill, you know, special deals for Nebraska that are going to come out anyway. But they don't want to have to cast a vote for it because they know what the 30-second ad is going to look like. Celeste Headlee voted for special deals, even though it'll never be in the final bill. So they just don't want to deal with that stuff. And they don't want to vote for a bill that's going to do that to them. So they're looking for a way to be shielded. The House Democratic leadership hasn't made a final decision on this gnarled procedure that we're talking about, but they're leaning towards it because without it, Celeste, it's possible they don't have the votes.
All right. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
I'm thinking about that gnarled vine of rules there, Todd, talked about. Our next guest is Tim Olson. He's the Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. He runs the Bureau's outreach campaign nationwide. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Great. We asked you on the program because we have a few questions about the categories that you see in the questionnaire there on the census, and all of you playing at home can bring up that questionnaire on the internet if you just go to the census or Google the census. But here's a question somebody had.
This is Michelle calling from Atlanta. Got my census information. It was a little unclear. I didn't know that blacks or African Americans would still be categorized as Negroes. Just kind of disturbed me. What's up with that?
What's up with that, Tim Olson?
We've heard this from many people. It's Negro is just part of the overall category on the form. This is black, African-American, or Negro. It's just a broad category that people can check off. It's really, when you look back at Census 2000, more than 50,000 people actually wrote in Negro.
Interesting.
And it was one option. Then we continued that for 2010. And if people are upset this time, the best thing I can say is just be sure to check off the race that best fits them. And 2020, it might be different.
Well, figuring out a name to call yourself is also an issue with same-sex couples or heterosexual married couples. And this is the first time the census is actually going to count gay couples, even though they don't have a category called gay couples, right?
Correct.
How does that work?
What'll happen is on every form, there's a person one. And then if there's more than one person in the household, those additional people will identify how they're related to person one. So if you have a household, two people, let's say two women, and person two says that they are related to person one, either as a married partner or as an unmarried partner, husband, wife, or unmarried partner, we will be able to actually tabulate that data and show how many same-sex couples there are in the United States.
In 2000, how many did you count?
1.2 million.
And they were in 97% of all counties within the United States. That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, you can't tell roomies from actual same-sex couples, though, right?
Correct. I mean, roommates is one of the categories on the form. Boarders, children, grandparents. There's many options for how people can be related to person one.
And I just love how interesting it is that every 10 years you have to re-examine the categories. Tim Olson, Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you.